Hey there, friends and folks. This is Six, and I wanted to get a quick spoiler warning out of the way for a couple of games. Here at the Gimmick Awards, we try to avoid spoilers whenever possible, but some categories kind of necessitate it, and Best Moment is definitely one of them. So please expect major plot spoilers in this category for Pokemon Legends Arceus, The Quarry, Splatoon 3, Pentiment, Witch on the Holy Night, Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2, Immortality, Final Fantasy XIV Endwalker, and Final Fantasy Origin Stranger of Paradise. So with those spoiler warnings out of the way, you should have a sense as to whether or not this episode is safe for you. And now we'll get on with the episode. Hello, friends and folks, and welcome to Scanline Media's 2022 Gimmick Awards. We're here to talk about the media that we experienced and appreciated over the course of 2022. I'm Six Detmar.
I'm Jennifer Unkle.
And I'm Kyrie Page.
And we're here for the Best Moment or Sequence category. One of these days, you know, it's still a slightly clumsy name.
But, you know,
here we are.
We'll find something, you know.
Let's just change it to Best Moment.
Yeah.
Like, we're not rules lawyering. We know what we mean.
Exactly.
And people listening know what we mean.
Exactly. So. Best Moment. Put it down.
We have a list of nominees here. From it, we are looking for one winner and two runners-up. However, we can flex the number of runners-up if necessary. Jen, it's a long list, but can we ask you to read it?
Sure thing. From Pokemon Legends Arceus, we have Quelling Noble Pokemon or The Walk into Exile. From Guilty Gear Strive, we have Nailing a Combo Recipe from the Combo Maker. And Razzo Sends a Message at CEO 2022. We have Prison Breakout Flashback from
Quarry. Just say it. If you do rehab, we'll be here forever.
I'm sorry. Pros Shattering the Score Ceiling with Rolling from NES Tetris. Ending the Mammalian Plot from Splatoon 3. Hackling to Maximum Profits with Potionomics. Mouthful Mode from Kirby and the Forgotten Lands. From Pentiment, there's Act 2 to Act 3 Transition. And Font Reveal. From Super Smash Bros. Melee, Amsama brings the... Amsa brings down the big house. From Batman Arkham Origins, Batman says, "A-cab." Which on the Holy Night has Kixieland, the Kingdom of Flat Snark, and Alice Goes Penguin Mode. Sifu has the Ageless Run. From Lifeline, Shoot the Table. From Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2, Microwaving a Fork. Splatoon 2, Reaching the Tidepool.
Read it again.
Hmm?
That was right.
Which one?
She said Splatoon.
Oh, okay.
Oh, she did. You're right. Huh. I didn't even notice.
Spelunky 2 has Reaching the Tidepool. From Final Fantasy XIV Endwalker, the Level 83 Trial. From Immortality, Cracking It Open. From Stranger Paradise, You See, You Forgot. And from Neon White, Go Faster / 610 Race Platinum.
That's a lot of moments.
It is a lot of moments. Gosh, hard to know what to cut here. I guess we can start with the easiest cut. There is basically the only reason Batman Arkham Origins is on here is because I played it in 2022. It's not a 2022 game, kind of by any definition. I didn't even stream it, so I can't use that argument. But the part where you, like, have a section of the game where it's like, ah, shit, I have to infiltrate the Gotham City Police Department, And Alfred's like, sir, perhaps we could find some non-lethal way, you know, some very more gentle way to deal with these city servants. And Batman's like, they're all corrupt assholes. I'm going to kick the shit out of them. I'm like, yes, thank you, Batman.
Thank you, Batman, the ultimate cop. Yeah, it is fun to see.
That's also like right before Gordon becomes commissioner, right? Because I feel like that's the one kind of niggle on that specifically, because basically all of Batman fiction tends to be like, oh yeah, Gotham City Police Department was way more corrupt before Jim Gordon got in and strayed them all out.
Right. Yeah, that is definitely the implications. It's like, but all it takes is one good cop. I mean, yeah, it's a holy compromise thing. It's
holy
not
comp. Yeah. So I have a few we cut. I wanted to put in some moments, and there's some that I'm gonna definitely want to talk more about, of like moments that happened in relation to gaming. But we could send off. Razzo sends a message at CEO 2022. I will say, like, and I don't know if I need to post a link to it, but, you know, on the stage at CEO 2022, when handed the mic, you know, Razzo, you know, after saying, like, it's obviously not, you know, a simple thing to just go, you know, say, oh, trans rights, and everybody claps, right? But that was the weekend the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, and when you had Razzo saying, and fuck to the Supreme Court, to a crowd of cheers and roars, it was great. It was wonderful. It was like, it kind of captured the awkward energy of that weekend, and I don't know, it was just nice to hear. I don't think they necessarily went very far in that tournament, but it is good, like, you know, using that sort of platform to say something like that. It's like, I don't know, I find that kind of commendable. And again, it was just nice to hear. And also the thing that's nice is that, again, the crowd clearly in agreement and the commentators also in agreement. It's just a nice reminder that, like, oh no, there are sensible people out there.
I mean, on that one, it's most of America, right? Like, the Supreme Court is not enacting a popular decision. They are just pushing their agenda, right? Whereas some issues, it's very much like, it feels like us against the world, where this one is just, you know, evil conservatives doing evil conservative things.
Right. So it's good to just have people say, hey, fuck you. It's great.
Yeah.
But you can go.
What is Mouthful Mode doing on here? That's not a moment. That's a game mechanic.
You get to inhale a car and become a car, Jen, in Kirby and the Forgotten Lands. Like, it doesn't win, but it's a lot of fun. Like, it's a fun twist on, like, Kirby mechanics.
Yeah, I mean, I read it as, like, the debut of Mouthful Mode, right? The first time you use it, you know?
Yeah, and it's so funny in the beginning of that game when you use Mouthful Mode for the first time, you become a car, and it cuts to, like, the credits sequence, and Kirby as a car pulls up to a radio and starts playing the theme song. It's like, it's just a cute, you know, moment that really sets the tone for that game.
Yeah, that part's pretty good.
But also, you just get to, you know, like, just the moments in that game where you see something big and you're like, oh, I get to inhale this massive thing and become like a shelf for a while, or I get to, you know, become like, I think you inhale like a massive donut, and like you basically become like a, it's hard to describe, it's like a popper that like sends out bursts of air. It's good fun. We're allowed to have fun, Jen.
Yeah, I just, it should have been put something like Kirby swallows a car, or Kirby becomes a car, or something like that, because just saying Mouthful Mode, it's like, okay, could you...
Well, you read it wrong. It's Mouthful Mode! I wrote it in all caps for a reason.
Okay.
But it can go.
Yeah. I don't... not gonna fight for it in the top, but Let me talk about microwaving a fork in Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2, because it's just like, what has this game become?
Okay. I need to hear this.
So there's the classic. So Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2 is sort of a remake of Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2, right?
Mm-hmm.
It makes a lot of changes. It introduces entire new arcs and stuff that doesn't exist. But fundamentally, there's the whole, like, oh, General Shepard's here, and he's going to betray us and work with not Blackwater, right? And the part where you are initially betrayed is by Blackwater, and it's like, oh, shit, you're without your gear and trapped in a town where these mercs have the city on lock, is where they introduce some new mechanics. They introduce crafting.
Okay.
You don't have a gun, and you are going around, and it's like, it's very Last of Us crafting, but even more ridiculous, because it has full first-person animations, so you see your character, like, lift up a bottle of bleach, a jug of bleach, and, like, duct tape a mouse trap to it, and it's like, there, now I have a proximity chemical mine. And you're like, what are you talking about? Why does that work? The mouse trap wouldn't... Anyway, so that's how that works. You're building, like lock shims to break open, like, locked doors and locked things. You're building mines and Molotov cocktails and stuff, and it's all very stupid. And then you get your gun back, and you go back and you play Call of Duty some more, right?
Right.
And then you get to the end of the game, and you've tracked down the big bad, and you're facing him on this, you know, on this, like, building, this skyscraper that he's secured. And, oh man, they get the drop on you, and they run, but you drop your rifle down an elevator shaft, and now you don't have a weapon. And so the crafting system makes a return, but there's a new element. So basically, you have to take down all of his guards to face him alone. For some reason, magically, whenever you kill them, their guns now just have one or two bullets in them, which is fun, tensely, because it's like, I have one or two shots, I better be smart with them. But mostly you are just, you know, like, building, you know, like, knives out of glass and duct tape and stabbing people. But how do you lure them into position? There are microwaves scattered around the map.
Wait a minute. microwaves, plural?
Plural. There are multiple microwaves. And you're like, I'm just going to toss this chunk of metal in the microwave and hit start. And a guy wanders over and is like, huh? Like, that's their equivalent of knocking on a wall, is microwaving a fork. And it's just so stupid, I had to mention it here.
God.
How big is this area to require multiple microwaves?
It's like a... You know, it's like a, it's an office building, and it's like the dining room floor kind of thing. It kind of almost makes sense. It doesn't really, because they're really spaced out, which doesn't make any sense. But, you know.
Okay.
Given how hard that game is trying to be, like, setting up its own Marvel Cinematic Universe, that's very funny that it just has a segment like that.
That is a dark phrase. Like, well, it's true. Call of Duty Cinematic Extended Universe.
There's a bit where, like, they're talking about, well, where are we going to compose a team? And the guy's just like, I know a guy. And
he's
suddenly,
in the Black Ops.
Suddenly the helicopter pilot turns around, and it's the guy who used to be your helicopter pilot throughout the original Modern Warfare series. And it's like, okay. This is supposed to hit emotionally, but it does not.
I don't think they're trying to create a Marvel Cinematic Universe. I think the language of the Marvel movies has gone through people writing in less considered spaces, and they just use it without realizing what it means.
I mean, there's also the whole logo thing they have now in that game.
The shadow of Joss Whedon haunts us all.
But yeah.
Let's see, other ones that are not going to make it. There's a distinct hostility for Neon White in this room, so I'll go ahead and cut this one, even though I think it's really cool. There is a level called Go Faster. It's called Race, excuse me. It's level 610. And it starts, so the way Neon White levels work is you have to kill every enemy, and then the exit turns on, right? So you are killing them on your way to the exit.
Mm-hmm.
There is an enemy type called a tripwire, which is basically, imagine a gun that shoots whatever's in front of it. It has one bullet and it fires straight ahead. So it acts like a trip mine, but kind of, but the mine is a bullet.
Mm-hmm.
And they also do this when you hit them. And so the level is a just a ton. There are normal enemies. There are a handful of them. But mostly it is just like 30 of these things pointing at each other. So you hit the very first one and it fires a shot that triggers the next one and the next one and the next one. And the very last one shoots a platform that you need to finish the level. So basically you trigger the first one, and then you are racing the chain reaction to get to the door before the exit is destroyed.
Hmm.
And that's a fun level. But you do it, and you do it over and over, and you do these various optimizations, and you're like, I just can't hit this platinum medal time. I don't know how I'm supposed to do this. Like, there's a hard gate on how fast these reactions go off. And what you realize is, to get the platinum medal, you have to help the mines go faster. You have to intentionally trigger extra reactions along the line to speed up the chain reaction.
Like, you have to shoot it?
Yeah, you have to shoot mines in the middle to be like, okay, like, I'm breaking the chain, but the mines I've already shot will trigger up to the stopping point, and then it will continue. So, yeah, it's like you are in a line of dominoes. You are knocking down the first domino, and then the 20th, and then the 30th. So, really, you only need to get a good enough time, you really need to hit like the first and like the 25th or whatever. Mm-hmm. But the moment of realizing that this thing that has been what you are racing against, this trap you are attempting to escape, you go, trap, you're going too slow. I need you to speed up.
That's pretty cool.
Like, it's really cool.
That sounds like a really cool expression of like what that game is going for. And that aha moment is like, that sounds really cool. I didn't play a lot of Neon White. And by a lot, I mean none at all. But
yeah, and Jen hates it on principle, so.
I enjoy playing the game a fair bit. I just think that one of the creators is a huge asshole, but that's a different thing.
Yeah, that's what I mean. That's like, mm-hmm. You know.
Yeah.
Jen's not going to want it on any list, so.
I got another that I don't think will make it to the top. I do want to talk about it because it is... Oh, hold on. Let me see. Okay. So, I'll just briefly talk about it. Like, one of the things they added to Guilty Gear Strive in 2022 was a combo recipe maker and player. And it's a simple thing. And, like, obviously the act of, like, you know, you want to go into training mode and learn your combos. It's like, that's, you know, that's what people have been doing for a very long time. And they introduce a thing where basically, you know, if you're familiar with mission modes in fighting games, it's like, okay, do these sequences, and nominally it tries to teach you like a combo, but most of the time it's not really optimal, so they have this community tool. But I just think it's really nice the way it is set up, how you download it, and how you execute on it, and how gently encouraging it is to you actually doing the combo, even if it's a, at first, seemingly complicated thing. I don't know. I just think it's, like, it's a really effective tool, and the way it, you know, it's a simple thing of saying you rock when you, like, you know, do a 10-hit or a 10-input combo effectively for the first time, is, like, it's just really cool at guiding you into why it's fun to do a combo in the first place. Which, there are people I have talked to who do not understand the appeal. And I think, like, for a, ostensibly a trainer for people who want to get better, like, it is a good way to make people take that step, but also it is encouraging, and it's almost like a fun game mode in and of itself.
Mm.
Yeah, I mostly am just like, more than having a great moment with it, it's just, it's a feature that I'm really glad is here.
Mm-hmm. And almost like, you know, when we talked about rollback a number of years ago, it's like, almost every fighting game should have this, because, you know, it just means like getting that information is much easier, and also having it built to actually give you the feedback that you need rather than, hey, here's this combo and dust loop, to figure it out. Like, it's such a good tool for people who want to get better.
We can cut the Ageless Run. Sifu is a game that has a fairly punishing aging mechanic as, like, its punishment for getting, like, knocked out in its Souls-like mechanics, right? And it just feels really good when you do a run where you don't get downed at all. That's sort of like... Because it isn't like Dark Souls, where it's like, oh no, if you die, you have to start the run over. But it is like, how much has the run cost you, and how much will it, like, impair your progress going forward? And having the run where you just do it in the game that is very much, like, toned around, you know, the martial arts master feel of, like, you know, being untouchable and having the perfect answer to everything, feels really good.
It's almost like it is doing the... When you get that run happening, it is like watching the kung fu movie the game clearly wants to be, where you the viewer, have not seen the actor practice this scene hundreds of times. But, like, you get to, you go through that experience, and then when the Ageless Run happens, it's like, oh no, you are executing it perfectly, and that's cool.
Yeah, I mean, you have seen the actor practice it. You were the actor, and you've been practicing. So, it's cool. I guess we can also cut Shoot the Table.
That's
from
just
Lifeline.
That's just funny.
It's just funny. Lifeline is a 2022 game because of the time we spent with it. We're recording this just after Valentine's Day. I was planning to stream yesterday, and I realized that I was going to be streaming Lifeline on Valentine's Day, and given some of the stuff that game does with that character, I was like, actually, I don't want to do that.
Let's not. But Lifeline is a funny, is such a bizarre, like, time capsule of a thing that, of, like, because there was that hot minute in gaming where people were like, man, you want to be able to talk to the game, and it reacts, and it, you know, does the thing you want it to do. Isn't that cool? And then just it just wasn't there at the time.
It was very cool. It was very cool. It still is. But doesn't mean it's very good.
Right.
And the Shoot the Table moment, we were all streaming together, and on a lark I told Rio, our female protagonist, to shoot the table with her gun from about 6 inches away. And it cuts to, I was like, I figured she wouldn't do it. I was just sort of getting frustrated and wanted something to amuse me. And it cuts to, like, it, like fades to black and fades back in. She's pointing the gun at dead center of the table and fires. And there's a beat. And then she just goes, I missed. Like, right, great. Everything I could have asked for.
God. I am now just thinking about how there was an announcement earlier this year of, like, Mountain Blade being like, oh, we're going to use chat AI. You're going to be able to put in your responses. And it's like, man, that's stupid.
I want to do a correction for that. That's not the actual Mountain Blade developers.
I know. But yes. Yes. But also, that is, like, for some reason, that is, like, people's idea now of, like, oh, wouldn't it be cool to, like, put in a thing and the peasant responds to you? And it's like,
what if you can tell your men at arms to do a sexy pose?
Yeah, type into the thing, say to guard at gate, do a sexy pose.
It is kind of incredible to think that, like, people really think a peasant would just turn to you and explain their whole life story instead of just being like, what are you doing? Fuck off, I got a farm here.
Well, I mean, they'll probably go, please don't ruin my life. You have the power to do that without a thought.
Do a sexy pose.
Do a sexy pose.
All right.
I want to... I bet it's very cool.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if pros shattering the score ceiling with rolling should be on our top list, because I don't care about NES Tetris.
Sure. No. I just want to talk about how ridiculous it is to see that, like, the moment in question is more... Have you ever seen a game solved?
Like, yes.
Which one are you thinking of?
Third Strike is what I'm thinking of.
Third Strike?
Third Strike is solved. It's still fun.
It's still fun, solved, but though. Sure, but like, I don't think it happens very often that you get a moment in a competitive game that is like, oh, no, people just found the correct answer to every scenario. Mm-hmm. And what has happened is that people who play NES Tetris competitively have figured out a stance where basically they hold the controller in a way and tap the bottom of the controller while their thumb is on the D-pad. And basically this completely breaks the game because pieces are now moving to the left and right of like the well at speeds the programmers did not account for. And it is causing problems. And, like, I was going to, like, talk about it and disqualify it mostly because it's like, okay, guys, you probably need to move on to another game at this point. If that is the answer. Like, let me send you a clip. Hold on. It'll take just 1 minute. There we go. If you want to just take a look, and I'll describe it. But basically, the speed at which the pieces are moving to the sides of the well should be impossible. But once again, people dedicated to this game have found a weird workaround and has caused like people are now doing games where the score display is rolling back to zero. And that's kind of ridiculous, but also it means that tournaments that they're holding is causing them to go over the time limit of the venue they have rented. But yeah, it can ultimately go, but it is like, I just think it's like cool when a competitive game or almost any game gets like taken to its most logical limit.
Yeah, I think I think I answered your question a little flippantly. I think actually the only game I've seen be solved is Donkey Kong.
And like maybe original Super Mario Brothers on NES, but that's like a speed running problem. But
pretty rare thing.
Now if they played Tetris Battle Gaiden on Super Nintendo, then we'd be talking.
It's a good game.
That has a matchup chart and everything. It's a real game. No, I'm kidding. We can also cut ending the mammalian plot of Splatoon 3. That ending is fun. It's cool. It's, you know, it's this, you know, throughout the story mode, you are assisting the Squid Sisters in trying to figure out what is causing this, basically this, like goop that's all over the land. Anything that touches it becomes, like, a massive ball of fur. And the ending of the game, as described when we talk about like best music, is like you are sent on this rocket ship as the Squid Sisters in Deep Cut are singing you a song to fight a massive bear, Mr. Grizz, by the way, the guy who gives you the mission in Salmon Run. Turns out he's been plotting to turn the entire world into a big fuzzy ball. And it is like really cool how in that final, like that final sequence, like you're knocked off the spaceship, but like Octavio from the first game story mode actually rescues you and is like, oh, come on, we gotta take this thing down. And it's cool. I will say the moment is kind of mired by the fact that like the gameplay moment that you are doing is not that clearly communicated to you. And like a lot of things, sometimes like your big epic ending can kind of be stymied by the fact that you're playing a game. And it is a little frustrating to have to go through it a couple of times, like, which is clearly in pace with like the music that it's trying to do, but you still fail at it. But it's still just a really cool moment to like, just it has a lot of miniature moments like in it, like the little salmonoid that's been following you around becomes this massive creature and starts basically having a giant kaiju fight with the bear, and you are also fighting the bear. It's fun. You should try that story mode if you have that game. I think it's a really entertaining time, and I'm really interested and excited in that off the hook DLC that they are that they showed off recently.
It also helps in its that like works in its favor that the ending of Splatoon 2 kind of sucks. You just fight Octavian again.
Mm-hmm.
And so actually doing something this time, yeah, that's cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really fun. Again, just that moment of you're drifting out into space thinking all is lost, and then DJ Octavian, like, shows up and starts piloting your ship for you. It's, like, it's cool.
Mm-hmm. We can cut reaching the tide pool, I guess.
That was a fun moment for us. Because we were on stream together at that point, I think.
I think, or you were there for that.
Yeah, when you got that far in Spelunky 2.
Yeah, so, it's the fourth world of Spelunky 2, or one of two, as I've now learned. And Spelunky 2 is a game that is very much like playing with your expectations by doing stuff. It's like, oh, this is like a twist on the first one, right? You start off in the caves and there's the jungle, but you could also go to the volcano, which is a take on, like a lighter take on hell from the first game. And oh, here's Olmec and blah, blah, blah. And then you end up in an area that's like, oh, this is all different. I don't understand. I don't recognize anything. I mean, I do recognize something here. The Jiangshi. They use that from one of the possible seeds that can occur in Spelunky 1. But everything else, it's like, oh, this is like an underwater Chinese palace? Yeah. What am I looking at?
Also, the like bright colors is such in contrast to like the first, like Spelunky 2 is like really nice to look at, obviously, in its first like major sections, but like you're mostly looking at a brown palette, which makes sense, you know, you're underground, but then you emerge into the tide pool and it is these like jade and like light blues just sort of like permeating everything, and it's like, oh, you have, like, it feels like you've dug deep enough to, you know, a massive building completely covered by the like shifting of time.
Yeah, it's really cool. But you know, it can go. It's okay. I think I have things I would fight for it over that. So
yeah. I think we should probably cut the prison breakout flashback from the quarry. It's a really neat sequence, but I'm not sure if it hangs with everything else here. Like, it's basically a bit where the quarry. It's another game by the folks who did Until Dawn, Supermassive Games, and there's this whole bit at the beginning where you're spending time with two camp counselors who are attempting to get to the location early for summer camp, but don't quite make it in the way they're supposed to. It kind of ends in an ambiguous note that makes you think that both of them died, but at a certain point, the one of the two people from that beginning sequence ends up running to the other camp survivors like weeks later, bandaged and clearly in a bad state, and she basically tells about everything that happened like in between that gigantic span of time, and you kind of get to play it out in the sequence where you're trying to trick the sheriff, played by Ted Raimi, who does a fantastic job, into letting his guard down just enough so that you can get the hell out of there.
And, yeah, there's a lot of like mini, like, I mean, the thing that was surprising to us, because Jen and I were playing a mode where we both played different camp counselors, and she played throughout the whole tutorial section, which is just like, I forget her name off the top of my head. But then we get the prompt on screen. It's like, oh, hand the controller to Jennifer. This like counselor is back. And it was kind of like, oh, we are going to address this. And it's kind of cool. And there's a lot of moments that like you have to very carefully over the course of like montage weeks to be able to like, you find a loose brick so you can keep an item behind it, and you can keep like a syringe that you find in the rare moment in which you're able to walk out of the prison cell, and you have, you know, a very limited amount of time. But if you have done like like, because there's tarot cards you can pick up and you get flash forwards to give you hints as to the best way to go through the game. We knew we had to get that, so we found a way to put the syringe behind the brick and at just the right moment, you know, arm yourself with it to take out the sheriff and make your big escape. It's a really considered and really cool sequence. Handicapped a little bit by the fact that it is a big flashback sequence, so like a lot of the tension of it doesn't necessarily carry forward, but also there it is still just a cool way to play out that moment, and that's where you get some of the biggest reveals about what is going on in that game.
Yeah, it's one of those moments that reminds you that, like, as much as we shit on Quantic Dream and David Cage and all that stuff,
good reason.
Yeah, for good reasons. Like, there is something compelling to the idea of, like, trying to think out how you're going to trick this person in the moment and interacting with them in a specific way you don't see in other genres. And that's something that Supermassive does incredibly well when they're given the chance.
Yeah, they realize that, yeah, a slasher movie is corny as all hell, so lean into how corny it is, and you can have a lot of fun. And also play against and with the expectations the audience would have being familiar with these types of movies.
Yeah. Okay, I should tell you what this is, so we know what we're talking about here.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
You both have played Final Fantasy XIV.
Yes.
Yes.
Final Fantasy XIV Endwalker.
The hit MMORPG that you can play for free up to...
Yeah, through Heaven's Word. So, you are chasing one of the last Ossians. This is a group of people who worship the god of darkness, Zodiark, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, basically the deal in the setting is that an event happened that split the world into 14 parallel versions of itself. And the Ossians are like, every one of them is like a fragment of reality. We need to combine them.
Mm-hmm.
And the way you do that is by blowing various realities up. And so everyone in the various realities is like, yo, fuck that. Right?
Right.
So you are chasing one of the last ones, and he is, there are some interesting reveals about his identity. Ossians like reincarnate unless you can do something to stop this, but naturally they will reincarnate. And thus it's possible that they have, you know, had multiple lives, and you learn about their past lives. And this guy has had a couple of pretty interesting lives that have been important to the history of the story so far. He's a great inventor, and you have him cornered, and he runs, and he uses a device, and he teleports away. And you run up, and you're like, I guess we should follow him. And everyone's like, we don't know how this thing works. Your inventor friend is with you, and they're like, this doesn't even look like a computer to me. I don't understand what I'm looking at. If you really feel confident, we can hit the go button, but we don't know what's going to happen. But you're the main character, so you're like, it's fine. They're not gonna kill my PC right now. Don't be ridiculous.
Don't be ridiculous.
And then you're on the moon. And you're like, oh, I'm on the moon now, huh?
Yeah.
And then on the moon, there is like a 40-foot tall guy who's like, ah, you're finally here. Let's talk about what's going on. I've been expecting you. And he's like, yeah, no, that guy came through here. I think he was going to Zodiark. And you're like, yeah, huh? It's like, oh, yeah, Zodiark's here. We locked him up, but he's just here. And you're like, okay, I guess I'll go fight this guy to stop him from releasing the God of Darkness, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you run to the jail cell, and it's like, oh, no, you're too late. Your level 83 trial, like, barely a third of the way to this expansion is killing the God of Darkness. That's how we're starting. And then we're going to keep going for 7 more levels.
That's pretty crazy.
It's really, you're like, level 83? Are we doing this right now? What's going on? This guy's been hyped up for, like, a decade.
Yeah, because, like, you know about the Ossians from, like, the start of the game, don't you?
Uh-huh.
Those are the guys. Yeah. That's,
and like every plot almost has been, I mean, you know, there have been plots about like internal politics, but every big world ending threat has been about the God of Darkness. And then he's not even the mid boss of this expansion.
Yeah, that is like
he's a warm up.
God,
the audacity of that really floored me. Also, it's a very cool fight.
Mm.
That sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah.
So I have trouble seeing that go.
I think we can hold it for now.
Okay. Of our two Witch on the Holy Night moments, I was thinking about it, and I actually want to cut Kixieland here, because I think it's a little too big for the scope of this award. It kind of ends up being like a long chapter of the game.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, to lay it out, you are playing Alco, who's a witch, and her specialty is beams, right? Mm-hmm. She just shoots beams. And every other magic user is like, I fucking hate that girl. She is artless. She's got no technique. All of her stuff, like, she's just, like, brute force. But also, she's really, really, really good at it. And that scares the hell out of us, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Alco has a mage partner who is teaching her named Alice. And Alice has what other mages would call very sophisticated magic. She invokes fairy tales and makes them real. Which will play into both of our moments here.
Mm-hmm.
And the Kixieland one is Alco calls out a guy who she's like, this guy knows that we're mages. I have to kill him. She calls him out to an abandoned, out of business theme park. Cause it's like, it's, you know, a really quiet place for this to happen. And, you know, I can cover it up more easily. And because he's the male protagonist, he basically unintentionally convinces her not to kill him. And so she's like, you know what? Actually, I think we're going to do something else. And she's getting ready to leave. They're both getting ready to leave together. And Alice is there at the gate and is like, what the fuck are you doing? We are supposed to kill this guy. And they have a brief argument about it. And Alice says, that's fine. If you're too soft-hearted to do this, I can take care of it. Don't worry about it. And she turns the amusement park into a fairy tale. By way of a summon of hers called Flat Snark. And so basically what this means is that, like, dragon-shaped roller coasters are now, in fact, roller coaster dragons. There are little, like, bread golems marching around everywhere because for some reason the amusement park creator was obsessed with bread.
Sure.
That's such a funny detail, too, because, like, his whole thing is like, I'm a bread magnet. I'm going to make my own theme park.
I'm going to make my bread with bread.
Well, he made a theme park where every single concession stand was just a bread stand and wondered why no one wanted to be there.
The background for it is also very funny. But yeah, it's just this moment where, like, the fairy tale nature of it seeping in is like, at one point they hide in a cafe and then it turns on them because obviously to make it fun, someone painted a clown on the ceiling. And that means the ceiling is now possessed and trying to kill them. It's a wild sequence. And it's also just, as a visual novel, an incredible spectacle. The use of, like, one of the genius things about Witch on the Holy Night, which is very much a consequence of their budget, no visual novel has ever had a budget this big, is that they do a very specific style of animation where it isn't like... It's like a static drawings that they are moving around, but finding very clever ways to move them, because at a certain point, it would be cheaper to just animate them anime style. But that's not what visual novels have ever done. So they do an incredibly elaborate version of, like, you know, a person swinging their sword and you can tell because their sprite, like, moved forward 5 pixels, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's really a gorgeous thing, but it is too big and too long to really be captured here.
Sure.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Alice goes penguin mode is a little easier to explain.
It sounds like Alice goes, yeah, define penguin mode, please.
Okay. So, Six is probably better at explaining this than I am.
So, This is a bonus story that is sort of an optional, like, story you unlock after beating the game, where it's a locked room, like, sort of a locked murder mystery story, because someone has accidentally invoked another one of Alice's summons. This summon is a very weird one, because its rule is basically, if you laugh, you die. If, while the summon is active...
Oh, man. Jerba, watch out.
They instantly die. And so it is this weird, like, horror comedy sequence of, like, the summon trying to make people laugh and seeing what people's sense of humor is and it murdering them. Like, there's one point where there's, like, the harsh, like, stone-cold, like, nun who's just, like brutal and, like, unsmiling to everyone. And then someone describes the bizarre way someone else was murdered, and she cracks up laughing and turns to stone and shatters. And this one is, there is a character who has joined the scene who is a magician who is also a rich brat idol girl. And kind of everyone hates her. The question is, to what degree do they hate her? Alice hates her enough to kill her. And so, in a moment where the power is flickering, Alice, this, like perfectly poker-faced character, like an incarnation of, like, a mix of, like, Japanese and British elegance, right? Like, the lights are flickering, and suddenly there is just a single shot of her standing there in a penguin costume. And the idol girl bursts out into laughing, vomits blood, and dies. And afterwards, you're the only other person the character you're playing as is the only other person who saw that, right? And you're like, Alice, what the fuck was that? And she's like, ah, I must have accidentally put on the wrong clothes. Don't ask me any more questions.
Yeah,
that's really fun.
It's worth mentioning that this idol girl already laughed once and basically had to resuscitate herself after her heart stopped over something as simple as just hearing the foolish boy character in it say some random French to her.
Yeah, this is great.
Sounds like we need to earmark that one. I have one that we get. I have one I cut real quick. Let's see. Haggling the maximum profit in Potionomics. This is a little bit of my, like I like putting, like, gameplay moments on here, and it is just really satisfying to, like, in this game, haggling is done through a card game mechanic, and basically your opponent is ostensibly the customer, has a certain amount of patience, and there's just something really fun in doing all the social links to get the cards you need and making a great, like, deck type that will allow you to haggle the person trying to buy your potion, like, to, like, its max limit, because there's basically a heart in the lower left corner, and as it fills up, the more they are interested in paying for the potion. And it's just, like, some of my favorite moments in that game is just getting on a roll of, like, 3 or 4 customers in a row, and I have built my deck in such a way that I'm able to get them to pay for the max every single time. Because it's a delicate balancing act of, like, instead of mana, you're basically, you know, spending the other, like, the customer's patience, basically. Because it's abstracting the idea of you trying to upsell this potion through patience and time mechanics. And it's just really, really, like, engaging. And it's, like, you know, it's ostensibly just sort of, like, card battle mechanics, but just applied in a non-combat framework. But that's, like, the really special power of, like, card mechanics, I think, in general. Because, like, there are so many layers of abstraction. You really can replicate a lot of different types of feelings and emotions through that play that I think Potionomics really excels at, when you just feel like this master salesperson able to, you know, sell this potion that was priced at, like, you know, 50 gold to 200 gold. You know, it's just really engaging and fun. I also quickly cut Quelling Noble Pokemon.
I'm glad you said it before I did.
Yeah, because, again, it's just cool. it's just really cool how they have recontextualized these big Pokemon fights as, like, it's not particularly complex, but I do enjoy the story implications of it, where you, in every other Pokemon game, is like, oh, this big, like, you know, Kyogre is going to drown the world. So you, 12-year-old, you gotta catch it. And it's like, oh, then I get to, you know, pet Kyogre, and now Kyogre is my friend, which is, like, entertaining, obviously. But I think it's really cool how in Legends Arceus that your job in that scenario of, like, fighting these massive Pokemon is just sort of like, no, you just gotta get them to calm down and, like, get them to stop, like, going on a rampage or whatever. But catching them, are you ridiculous? No, these are, like, really powerful, really, like, important Pokemon to these communities. Like, you can't do that. And I think that's cool.
It is. I think the problem with it is I don't mechanically think most of them are very fun. And also, like, just the logistics of it, they're like, oh no, like the you know, fucking, you know,
massive iceberg Pokemon,
right? Yeah. Right, has gone out of control. Pelt him with rice balls until he calms down. And you're like, this is stupid, you guys. This is real stupid.
I think it's fun because they do add some, like, gameplay wrinkles to it, and I think it's, like, an interesting way to cap off, like, chapters in that game, but it's not perfect. It can go.
Yeah. Yeah.
I do kind of want to talk about how, while we're on the subject of Legends Arceus, I really do love the walk into exile.
I did not get this far.
You didn't? Okay. So, when you have quelled the, like, fourth or fifth noble Pokemon, basically throughout, the point of this game is that there's this massive rift on top of a mountain. And it is, like, causing the time distortion. It's causing a lot of problems. It's causing, like, these Pokemon to go wild. And you go through this beat where you're on the last one and you quell it. And everyone is, like, taking a sigh of relief. And then what happens is the sky turns blood red as the fissure that has been in the skyline the entire time rips apart. Like, and so what happens is there's the character who's, like, the Shogun character. I forget his name off the top of my head. He looks at this. He looks at you, the player, who he is already kind of uneasy with you in specific because you are a person from another time and place who, yes, you are helping this community, but you are a disruption, right? Like, he flat out says, like, I don't know what happened here, but I can only point it to you. So he tells you, like, whatever's going on here, the only answer I have is, like, is connected to you. So I will allow you to walk out of this village rather than be, like, basically, like, he implies that he would, like, kill you where you stood, right? Like, it is an intense, like, like, he doesn't use that verbiage, but the language of, like, the cutscenes, the language used here is one of, like, oh no, this community is, like, really, really scared and they are looking for answers, and the only answer their leader has come up with, which the game frames as extremely short-sighted, is, like, you gotta walk out of here because they don't know what's going on. And so you have this moment where you have... I remember her name, the captain you've been kind of working with, Celine. She just basically says, like, she kind of, like, sighs and realizes, like, there's not much she can do except, like, basically walk with you to the edge of town. And you are put in front of the Team Galaxy's, like, headquarters. And then you have control of the character. And you can't do anything. You can't, like, go away from the path, but all Silene could just kind of do is say, please don't make this harder than it has to be. And everyone in this town is just kind of looking like a mixture of either scared or confused or just not knowing what's going on. And it's just this really quiet moment of, like, you have, like, oh, I might not be able to come back to this community again, which eventually you go through the end of the game and you figure out the problem, but it is a layered and shockingly mature moment for this type of game to, like, you have, like, the person who exiles you isn't necessarily incorrect, but he is, you know, making the wrong choice, but you in that moment can't convince him otherwise because the sky just turned blood red, right? Like, it is a effect, like, it works really well, and that's kind of like what I was referring to in a previous category of, like, oh, they actually made the story kind of matter in a Pokemon game.
I guess I haven't had this moment. I read a little about it before, just incidentally. And hearing your description and everything, I guess my pushback is I feel like the rest of the story doesn't make this work. I would worry because your character is a blank slate, smiling, order-following golem. Who has never done a single choice that someone didn't tell them to do, and usually the leaders of Team Galaxy, right? Like, that's... I know he's not supposed to be making the right choice, but I don't know how it's even vaguely coherent with the fact that the only things you've done are what he has ordered you to do.
I think that... I mean, the thing is, like... the leaders of, like, the Pearl and Diamond, like, tribe basically say what you're saying. It's like, this doesn't make sense. And he is basically saying, like, I need to, like, he is framed as impotent in his action in comparison to what is going on. And you say, like, the character that you are playing is, in fact, a blank slate. But, like, the look of, like, kind of heartbreak on the character's face is, like, they actually kind of did it where, like, the character you're playing is clearly betrayed in this moment, but realizes there's not a whole lot they can do. And, by the way, the next chunk of the game, you do find this, like, camp that there are people who support you. You find out Silene has sent her Abra that's been in her office the entire time to help you stay access to, like, your, like... mechanically, it doesn't change much. You still have access to all your Pokemon and items and stuff. But you can't go back to that village until you solve the problem. Like, your respite is in this, like, camp almost seemingly out of time as, like, you meet, like, this game's version of Cynthia to kind of, like, help you solve, like, the problem. But it's for many hours, it's like, oh, you can't go back to home base. You can't go back to your home, and you can't go back to the things that you may know. And it's like, I think it's effective in how familiar you've gotten with that village in, like, really actually carrying through on kind of the threat of being able to take that away from you. Like, it doesn't, like, I think it's interesting, and maybe it doesn't necessarily stay because, like, there are, like, other games who do this or that do this sort of thing better, but I just think it caught me off guard when it happened. Like, I knew we were I was entering the end game, but I was not prepared for, like, how well it, like, I'm kind of selling short, like, the dialogue a little bit, because, like, I distinctly remember when I'm reading the dialogue, it's like, okay, this actually, like, makes sense as the incorrect choice for this short-sighted person to make, but they have a point in a way. Like, it's I don't know. I it worked really well.
We can earmark it for now. I think sure. I'm not. Yeah, like, it's hard for me to imagine what the coherent argument is when, like, I didn't get there. I got really close, and nothing in the game points in that direction whatsoever. Anyway, I'll save that argument. We'll see what the other contenders are for the top three before we have that fight. Of Pentiment, I think the Act 2 to Act 3 reveal is much stronger than the font reveal.
Have you finished Pentiment?
Yes.
Okay, so you're familiar with what I'm referring to with the actual font reveal bit?
Yes, I am. I thought it was fine. I didn't think it was that special, frankly. So what Jen is referring to specifically with a font reveal, that's the easier one to explain. Throughout the course of this game, there have been several killings, right? You've been solving murder mysteries in this small Bavarian town in the mountains. And there have always been like weird, complicated like motives for the various, you know, suspects. You never feel quite confident who you're picking, right, as to being like the person responsible. And there's always a lot of like town politics and relationship dynamics caught up in it. But also every time you have someone who has basically any kind of feasible motive, you can discover that there is a slip of paper that has been delivered to them written in a very elaborate purple Gothic font. That is basically compelling them to, like, basically being like, remember what he did, right? Or like, remember how she died, you know, if you lost a daughter or something, right? And then says like, it like then says when the murder is committed, basically providing you like, this is an opportunity to get your revenge. It's very like, it's very pointed given the context, but on their own, the statements are quite vague. Like an example, you know, not using the terms, because of course they don't talk about like 8 p.m. and stuff like this, right? Mm-hmm. But imagine a note that said, remember what he took, 8 p.m. the church. They're all like that. And so you become increasingly convinced that probably it's not, this person isn't killing everyone, but there is someone who is prompting everyone to murder.
Yep. It's also worth mentioning that Andreas himself, like, everyone's conversations are handled through different script, depending on how he views those characters, and that can change at any moment. Like, if someone reveals that they have been reading a lot, or that they are involved with printing at all, he'll basically erase everything that's been written in a dialogue box and replace it with the new text that symbolizes how he thinks differently of that person.
Right. So the monks who do very elaborate like artwork have this very like fancy, like professional scribes have a very fancy Gothic script. There is a fancy style of cursive for people he thinks are educated. There is a very plain style of writing for people he considers peasants. There is the like letters being pressed onto the page in one instant for people involved with printing. And so it is very much like it changes based on his impression of the person, right? You get a couple of moments of it changing in real time. And there is a character who is a nun, a sister, who is living in a, like, self-imposed prison, basically. She is in a room attached to a church, and she is locked in that room, and she never leaves it. There is a window. She talks to people sometimes, but mostly she stays in there. She thinks about her life and her relationship to God, and she tries to process visions that God gives her. And she does this with the help of the local priest, Father Thomas. And there is a moment where you are like in the act three, when you are like, all right, we have figured out like, this is the place where like there is a special location underground that we have figured out about where everything is going down. And you're like, we're going to stumble in there and we're going to find evidence. We're going to leave. And you go in and the nun is there. And you're like, hi, why are you here? And she's like, oh, you know, I come down here sometimes. This is the temple, right? This is where I come to pray and to understand my visions. And basically, you gradually figured out that she hasn't known what she's writing, but Father Thomas has been instructing her, like sort of helping her interpret her visions and having her write them down on little slips of paper. And in that moment, her font changes to Gothic purple. Because she's not known it, but she's been the one writing notes to tell people to commit murder.
And Obsidian did write this game.
Yeah,
that's good. And you're saying, like, the transition from act two to three, like, is that the transition point, or is it?
No, this is like, the font reveal is very nearly the end of the game. It's part of the final sequence.
I see. Okay.
The act two to three transition. So as Jen mentioned, you are playing a character, Andreas Mahler. He is a artist. In Act 1, he is an aspiring artist who is working on a commission for the local monastery.
Mm-hmm.
And then Act 2, you're coming back years later, and you've made it big, right? And there are locally implications that you've let it go to your head and been an asshole. A bunch of people are like, hey, we wrote you letters and you never wrote back. And all your options are just to kind of be a bit of a dick and be like, ah, you know how it is. It's like, no,
oh, fame.
You.
Oh, yeah. So I am so busy painting so many cathedrals.
And he's very obsessed with how hard his life is. And, you know, art takes its toll on people, but his life is not that hard. You know, there are people who are like, Jesus Christ, you're coming into my house and complaining about, you know, all the rich people who want your work. Like, shut the fuck up.
Guys, my Audi isn't being delivered today. Ah, it's my third one. You'd think they'd get it right.
Well, but the thing is, he is so obsessed with art. He truly is. It's not about, like, gosh, I don't have enough money. He's just like, oh, I can't believe I have to paint these paintings of these stupid, vain people when I want to do true art, right? This is the guy he is.
Mm.
And I still like Andreas, but he's kind of up his own ass. And then Act 2 is all about, like, people are getting fed up with the church taxing the shit out of them, taxing them into starvation and sickness and death. And they are ready to rise up and riot. And then the person who is sort of instigating people gets murdered. And they're like, well, of course he was murdered by the church. Are you stupid? And you're like, no, 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 it's more complicated than that. Let me investigate. And they're like, okay, we'll give you time, I guess. You did investigation once before, and I guess that went okay. And finally, things go so bad. You pick someone to accuse, and they are dealt with. But in the process, someone innocent gets murdered. And, like, a lot of bad shit happens, and there's a moment where you're going, because they have locked all the monks in their library and their monastery while they investigate this, so they don't run or they don't kill anyone else, right? And you're going there, and the abbot there is a real asshole, and has been taxing them in starvation, and the leader of the mob is basically like, all right, we're letting you out. And I forget exactly how it goes, but basically it's like the fucking monks can't leave well enough alone, throw a few jabs. And there's a moment where the leader of the mob just like turns cold faced and just walks into the library and then walks back out. And you start to see this orange glow effect and you're like, he lit the place on fire. Right.
Oh,
and this is when the troops of the local lord, who of course has to defend the church, march in and start murdering everyone. And Andreas, seeing this, has the perfect reaction for this guy who cannot see material reality because he is so obsessed with art and with his own troubles. He says, oh my God, the books. And he runs into the library as it's burning and burning. Because, of course, this is an era where printing presses are starting to get going, but almost all work, and certainly all detailed work, is hand-drawn and painted on every book elaborately over months and months. And he runs into the library, and he runs back, and you see him, like, covered in soot, and he throws a handful of books, and he runs back in, and the camera pans up, and then it just starts reading out a bunch of text, and you're like, what is this text? And it's like, it is the judge making a formal judgment about, like, legal, you know, liability for any canceled contracts on Andreas Mahler on a part of him burning to death. It's just like, fuck. it's intense. It's such a good, like, every part of it is so well done because it is a tragic way for this guy to die, and it is heroic, but it is also the absolute wrong kind of heroics for the moment he's in.
Mm-hmm.
And the way they deal with it is, like, is very sad, but it also isn't, like, the game isn't crying over him. It's just taking a moment of being like, and the world moves on, and in a way that sucks too. It's amazing.
Yeah, and that's one of the big themes of the game, too. Like, even when you're in Act 2, you, like, see some of the kids you hung out with in Act 1 grow a little older, and then you just don't see some of them at all because they died at a very early age. And more than the murder mystery itself, that is kind of the point of the game. Like, you're dealing with this place changing over time and just seeing how so many lives get crushed, but still things move on. And yeah, I think you're right, Six. That moment is so much more powerful than the font reveal.
Because it sounds like the font reveal, like, that's just, that's, you know, the trick old murder mysteries do, which is like revealing who's behind it all. Not everyone, you know what I'm talking
about. I know what you mean. I just think
that you just had that look of like, oh, I need to like.
I just think there's a little bit more to it just because of the way that it sets you up just to see like the various font changes being the opinion of Andreas shifting and then seeing
there. Yeah. Okay. I understand.
I think it's a good, like, it's a good use of that mechanic, but in the moment, I just sort of went, ah, sure. You know, I wasn't particularly blown away. I was like, yeah, I guess that's a smart way to do this. Sure.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the act 2 to 3 transition is really remarkable. And then act 3, you play as someone else. You know? Because, guess what?
Yeah, your main dude, he's dead. Can't do much when you're dead. What's up with immortality?
Okay, so you're familiar with her story, right?
Yes.
And kind of how like everyone had this collective experience of playing it and just having an aha moment where you're realizing what exactly it is through the format it's doing.
Except that one guy on Steam who was like, how do I know when I'm satisfied? But yes.
Immortality is interesting because like it is like a specific mechanic that you're not aware even exists until you stumble into it. But once you do, it changes the entire tone of the story you're dealing with. Like, basically, immortality is about this cult actress, Marissa Marcel, who made 3 movies over various points of time and disappeared from the world. And you're basically going through those 3 films. You're basically going through the raw footage that they shot of it and seeing, like, the actors, the set pieces, all that. You click through scenes to kind of just get to the next scene. At a certain point, like, when you're playing it, you'll just notice that there's a similar, very subtle audio cue that happens every once in a while in the middle of a clip, like, at various points of the clip. And you have things like fast forward, rewind, stuff like that. At a certain point, and it'll be different for everyone who plays it, they'll eventually think of, like, rewinding when that cue is playing. And suddenly you realize that all this footage is alive in a specific way. Like, the moment that it happened for me was I was in a scene in Minsky where they were more or less making out in the bathroom, 2 characters. I heard the audio cue. I just thought for a moment, okay, I want to take a closer look at the scene and try and figure out what is happening during this audio cue because I've seen the audio cue play out other times. I hit rewind. Suddenly, the 2 people making out in the bathroom are replaced by 2 other people. 2 completely different looking people who are making out. And as you continue to review this footage, like, there's moments where suddenly one of those same characters will appear and, like, talk to someone frozen in time. Sometimes you'll rewind and everyone else leaves the scene. It's completely quiet. The character will just start walking up to you, specifically staring at you and addressing you, just explaining certain things encrypted in a cryptic way. And then there's sometimes where you rewind things. Very rarely, you'll run into a situation where one of those characters will appear and stab someone to fucking death. And it's this fascinating situation of, like, you're dealing with this sort of paranormal story that plays out in a way that kind of just unfolds to you in a way that makes you feel like you're the one discovering all this happening. It's very powerful, in a way, just to have this intense moments where you just rewind at a certain point and everything changes.
Like, that's the moment you realize this game is a horror game, though, right?
It is a horror game to a point. Yeah, I'd say so.
Hmm. I guess there are two left on this list we haven't explained.
I'll explain mine, because from the sound of the conversation, my other pick is just sort of guy plays a video game good. but it is, it's just a cool story. First off, I really don't care about Super Smash Bros. Melee, just in general, but it is really cool that there's a player known as Amza, who for years has been playing one character. He has been playing Yoshi, a character that has been determined to be mid-tier for the past 20 years.
And Melee is a game that is slave to tiers at a competitive level.
Yes, and the way this guy, after years of grinding, after nearly a decade of grinding, he wins one of the biggest tournaments in that scene. The big house is known as a super major, which is basically everyone in the scene is here. And the thing is, there are people who are character specialists in that scene. Like, if you know anything about competitive Melee, it's like, oh, it's the same six guys who win every tournament. It's like seeing this, you know, guy from Japan manage to, like, not only beat them, he beat them convincingly in this tournament. He was on the winner's side, and he never switched characters. Like, a game, as you said, is a slave to tiers that, like, you know, Fox and Marth and, like, several of the other high tiers are just played constantly at that level. The fact that he has elevated this one character to being, like, not viable, a, like, certified winner, right? Like, that's just inspiring, you know, to me. Where it's like, in the clip that I sent you to, it's like, the commentators are losing their minds because, like, this does not happen. This never happens. And it's almost the opposite of, like, the rolling problem that Tetris has. It's like, it's just proof that, like, there are some games that if you apply yourself hard enough and think about the game long enough, that you can, in fact, break a game that you thought was once solved. Right? Like, and come up with a novel solution. And
Yoshi is still bad.
Yeah.
It's like, I mean, bad is a little strong, but, like, Yoshi is still not a great choice for anyone who wants to be a competitive player. Yes. Yoshi is still a little too weak for that. And Amza overcoming that isn't like, it is partially y'all are underestimating Yoshi, but more than that, it's y'all are underestimating the human ability to overcome obstacles.
Absolutely, right. And maybe there is some world in which if Amza picked, like, you know, Fox or Falco and Marth, maybe he would have won tournaments beforehand, but it's very clear to me that he's just a guy who is like, no, Yoshi is the character that makes sense to me, that fits, you know, fits me like a glove, and this is the tool I will use to, like, break this down. And it's really just inspiring. And he would go on in 2022 to win so many other tournaments. Like, he would take down, like, you know, Mango, Leffen, and, like, a bunch of other dudes and make it look easy. Like, almost styling on them. Like, the way he plays in the grand final in Big House 10, it's incredible what he is doing with this character. It's just, part of the reason, like, when I was thinking about this category was I wanted to put this moment on there because sometimes there's just, like, that indomitable human spirit just coming through in, like, the competitive, in, like, any competitive scene. I think that's, like, cool and worth celebrating. And I don't know if it makes top three, but damn, it's just,
I kind of want it to.
I do too. I really, really do. Because some of our first conversation six, like, I brought up Amza unprompted. Like, seriously. Yeah.
And I think, like, you know, I hate to, you know, you don't like to feel like the awards are kind of compromised in any way, but I do think there is value, and I am okay with perhaps slightly diluting for the sake of representing the different types of moments that can speak to us, you know?
Yeah. Because, again, like, I'm not going to be out here, like, picking up Melee anytime soon, but I have gained kind of an appreciation for it, for seeing the way he plays. because, like, you know, in a game as set in its ways, seemingly as Melee is, like, to see someone come in and break out with that sort of thing and putting in the work, like, that's just really inspiring and cool.
I think the "you see, you forgot" moment from Stranger Paradise is probably going to go, not because it isn't really good, but, you know, it's a sort of moment we've had before. But Final Fantasy Origin Stranger Paradise is a story about four people with amnesia saving the world, right? And slowly realizing they've saved the world many times, and it keeps getting reset on them, and they keep getting reset. And the moment where you're like, there is a character who they do an excellent job of setting up, the king of the dark elves, right? Who is a shady motherfucker who is like, it's written all over JRPG. Every JRPG visual and dialogue language is about how one of the last twists is going to be this guy being like, "I'm glad you've stopped the Dark Lord. It means I can become him," right?
Mm-hmm.
And you are slowly getting memories back here and there as you kill big bosses. And you fight this guy because he has that moment, right? He does do the, like, "Ah, ha, ha, my new empire!" And you fight him, and you beat him. And you get another memory. You get a couple. And they're of the fact that this guy was sent here as, like, tech support for you. This guy is like your Otacon. He's here to help you get the mission done. And gradually, as you did this over and over, every time your memory got reset and every time you started to remember and get pissed about the situation, his memory was never reset. And so you would have these moments and you would be like, "Shit, this is fucked up. I can't believe, I'm sorry we were so rude to you. Let's band together. Let's make a plan to end this stupid cycle that is intentionally being perpetuated by evil shitheads," right?
Mm-hmm.
And you make the plan and you're like, "Listen, next time we meet up, it is going to be the final time and we're going to do this together." And he very sadly is like, "You won't remember." And Jack's like, "I will. You don't understand. This is Nakama, motherfucker. I will." And then, you know, you blink and you're out of the memory and he is lying there bleeding to death on the ground. And he says, "You see? You forgot." And then he fucking dies.
Stranger of Paradise is so fucking cool.
It's so good.
It basically defied all expectations and told, like, a strong-ass Final Fantasy story and really got its hooks into people.
Yeah. I guess I could see it... I'm not letting Walk into Exile beat this. Fuck
no,
you.
No. Okay. You don't have to be that mean about it. I was going to prefer... You could get rid of Walk into Exile. It's cool, but it's like, I don't know, it's like cool in context of like other Pokemon games. I still think it works on its own. I think it was still affecting, but no, the Walk into Exile, this is things that like other JRPGs and just other stories have done. It's just really novel, like what it's done well in this context.
Like a lot of things about Pokemon Legends Arceus, it's remarkable to see the Pokemon series be allowed to be ambitious for once.
Yeah, And that's not to say that like that moment is, you know, bad by itself and only good in the context of other Pokemon games. It's like, no, it's still a solid thing. I just think it like is beat out by like other moments on this list. I don't think that cracking...
just manners for a moment. It wasn't actually a fuck you to you. It was a fuck you at the moment that I'm realizing that I was about to cut it and I really don't want to.
No. Okay. How many do we have left? We have
we have five. We have six. I definitely think we cut Penguin Mode at this point. It's funny. It's a good joke, but like
it's a good
kind
joke.
Of operating on a different scale here.
Yeah. Good joke in a good game. I don't think Cracking It Open goes in there because like I like the games from that developer, but I didn't want to play a horror game, you know?
I mean, I don't know. Like, I'm with you. I have no desire to play Immortality, but, like, I don't know. It seems like a really cool idea and executed really well, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know that I want to sell it short.
Yeah, it's also a situation where, like, I'm doing a bad level describing it, but also, like, the acting on display from everyone involved from those moments is just on another level compared to everything else here. Like, the performances they gave are just spectacular in a way that is incredibly hard to describe in words and is something that you kind of just have to see in action to really buy into.
I... To make things easier for us, I'm going to embrace a technicality.
Mm.
Final Fantasy XIV Endwalker is not a 2022 game. It's only on the 2022 list because I didn't want to ruin things in 2021. And in the spirit of not ruining things, it's not going to take a spot away from someone in 2022.
Right. Also, it's like, it's a fun escalation of the conflict that makes you wanting more. And that's effective at doing what it needs to do.
You are fighting Kyrie on a floating like square of land, and very often these trial fights end up being like, oh, you're just on this square of ground in the middle of the void, right? And then comes the part where Zodiark does a ground AoE, and you're like, okay, I'm safely away from the AoE, and then he picks up the ground and spins it, and now you're in the AoE. It's sick.
That's cool as hell.
But yeah, I think we should do a top four here.
I think honestly, because of how passionate, the act 2 to 3 transition, Amza like winning Big House, cracking it open, and the you see you forgot moment from Stranger Paradise, like that feels right. Like I wouldn't want to lose any of these.
Right. It's like I don't see where the conversation could go that I would feel good about any of these leaving. Do you agree with that, Jen?
I think so too. Yeah, this is one of the rare cases where top four makes sense.
We had 23 nominees, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then who wins?
Honestly, I think Pentiment wins.
Yeah.
I think that sounds about right. Like, For the passion that comes from that game, I do not have, like, a counter to that, but also Pentiment, like, I like Obsidian games, I want to play that game, and now that you've told me about this, I'm like, oh, that sounds amazing, I need to play it myself.
Yeah, Pentiment is a game that is purely a, like, it is art, and it is writing, and that is the game, and the writing in this moment, like, is like stands far above the rest of the writing in the game, which is already almost always extremely good. The fact that it stands out that much in a game that is about writing is like, well, shit.
Yeah.
So shout outs to our winner, the Act 2 to Act 3 transition in Pentiment, with runners up Amza Brings Down the Big House from nominally from Super Smash Bros. Melee, but kind of from reality. Cracking It Open and Immortality. And you see, you forgot from Final Fantasy Origin, Stranger of Paradise.
We did it.
Yeah. Yeah. But what if we microwaved a fork, though?
Okay, now if there were, like, 100 microwaves in this building, like, okay, now we're on to something.
If you could microwave multiple forks at once and the AI would bug out and not know which microwave to go to, then we'd be talking.
That would be fucking talking. That's like moment of the year. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm happy with this list. This is great.
For sure. Some pretty remarkable stuff. And, you know, a lot of really well-considered games creating really striking moments. And some of them via the people playing them. Shout out to Amza.
Yeah. That dude rocks.
It's amazing. Like, imagine any other developer. There's like a re-release of Melee by now. Nintendo's the stupidest company
They're
in the world.
They're so fucking stupid. Could you imagine? Okay.
They even went as far as releasing new GameCube controllers and GameCube adapters for Switch and re-release.
That's the thing that like gives like I have slightly more respect for the Melee community, like putting up with Nintendo's bullshit.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Like, the problem is the Melee community is mostly toxic monsters, but yes. You know.
Yeah, yeah. Obs is a cool guy though.
Obs is cool.
Yeah. That's it, I think.
Yeah, that's it. We will catch you with more awards, but until we do, peace out.
See ya
later.